an ill-assorted collection of poorly matching parts forming a distressing whole. My guest, psychologist Gary Marcus, uses the word kluge to describe memory, language, and the human mind, and this is the way he uses the word: a clumsy or inelegant, yet surprisingly effective solution to a problem. His book is titled Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. Marcus says, think of the mind as a contraption held together with duct tape, as opposed to the smooth and seamless machinery of Google or a supercomputer. Memory, he says, is often unreliable and illogical, and he says evolution is partly to blame. Gary Marcus is a professor of psychology at NYU, also the director of the NYU, New York University Center for Child Language, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Gary Marcus, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. So give us an example of a kluge in the way that you use the word.
My favorite example comes from Apollo 13, where they had people on the space capsule had escaped, and the air filters weren't working. And they had some square air filters that basically went into circular holes, and they had very short period of time in which to put the whole thing together. And they used duct tape and socks, basically, to assemble the whole thing into something that the astronaut said it wasn't very pretty, but it worked.
And the idea that something that sort of looks inelegant and clumsy, to use your words, actually has an effect or can solve a
exactly.
problem.
Exactly. Another favorite one, I have this on my webpage, is a graduate student took a house air conditioner and put it on top of his car in Texas. So it cooled off the car, but it looked pretty ugly, and you know, it wasn't optimally efficient, but it got the job done.
But it seems to me that speaks to the inventiveness of the human imagination.
Well, kluges often are pretty clever. They're not always foolish. They're never sort of the best way you could do something. But they can be pretty clever. In fact, the word kluge, some people trace it to the German word kluge, which means clever. So sometimes another example is MacGyver making running shoes out of duct tape and floor mats.
And that takes me back. But you also say, there are a number of things that you say in this book, but you see this as this clumsy solution to a problem and raising questions about the human mind, mm-hmm. Memory, efficiency, gullibility. What are you saying?
So what I'm saying, for example, is that evolution often use off-the-shelf parts that kind of get the job done, but they're really not what you would want if you were building something from scratch. So our memories, for example, are not searchable in the same way that computer memories are, and that leads to all kinds of problems. So we search our memories in a kind of arbitrary way. We can't systematically say, I want everything that meets mm-hmm. a particular set of criteria. So there are many, many instantiations of this, but here's a simple one.
Go ahead.
You ask people the following two questions. You say, how happy are you with your life in general? And then how many dates have you had? And you get answers that are sort of independent. You ask the other way around, you say, how many dates have you had? And how happy are you with your life in general? And suddenly people's happiness very much depends on how many dates they had.
And that's the order of the question.
The order of the questions is completely changing how they're thinking about their own happiness. And that's because how our memory works. So you think about the first question, and then it sort of clouds all of your memory with effects about your dating. And then when you think about your happiness, that's all that's there in your head.
Well, let me go back to evolution. I want to pick up on that, but just go back to evolution as you see it, and often as it's defined as sort of this slow, I won't say perfection, but adaptation to mm-hmm. changing environments, that evolution is a problem solver. You say evolution can't think ahead. I mean,
that's
can't
right.
anticipate the future, and that's part of what the mind, the memory is struggling with.
Exactly. So people sometimes think of evolution as an optimizer, and sometimes evolution does make things optimal, but it can't look ahead.
Meaning
it can't
better.
Well,
or best.
It can make things better, but making them best is sort of an occasional thing. So mm-hmm. evolution, other things being equal, make things better, but sometimes it comes up with solutions like the human spine, which is a nice way of getting us to be upright, but it's not a very good way. So we have back pain, and it's not a very kind of sturdy solution. So evolution can't say, well, you know, we've worked with this for 100,000 years, this human solution, it's pretty good in some ways, but like people are too aggressive, their back hurts, let's kind of start over here. Evolution doesn't have any foresight, it doesn't have any hindsight. And so, and especially because it works with what's already there, right. it sometimes winds up with clumsy solutions.
Well, and you talk about evolutionary inertia. I mean, that's a phrase used to describe this process.
Exactly. So inertia in general means that something that's at rest stays at rest, something that's in motion tends to stay in motion. And in evolution, what that means is, like, once you have a single column supporting the body weight of a quadruped, if you change it, you're probably going to change it in a small way. You're not going to start over from scratch and say, maybe four columns with shock absorbers would be the right way to hold up a biped. More likely, evolution is just going to make a tiny modification. It might not be the best solution.
And using that example, sort of built on then old machinery. I mean, the machinery that was adapted to, you know, previous environments, and then you're just adding an extra little gizmo on top of that.
Exactly. So Darwin talked about descent with modification. Everything that's out there basically can be traced to some previous organism that was similar, and there's a little bit of modification. So we can be traced to apes, and apes can be traced to monkeys, and so forth and so on, all the way back to bacteria. So there is slight modifications in each generation, but nothing ever starts from scratch. Everything is sort of, you tinker with this, and tinkering is sometimes a sort of stopgap strategy.
Well, you talk about the spine, and I think, as you know, anyone listening probably sat up straight as I did thinking about the spine. I mean, that's a very concrete example of something that allowed us to be upright and allowed us to use our hands and our thumbs and all the good things that we like to use, but as you say, came with back problems. You say that memory is, quote, the mother of all kluges. Why?
Exactly, because our memories evolved to be good at sort of general tendencies, so there's more food up the mountain than down the mountain, but it's not very good at specific examples. So let's say you're looking for your car in a parking lot that you park every day.
Right.
In the ideal world, each time you got into your car, you would forget where you had just parked because it would no longer be relevant. Instead, you remember every one of the times where you parked in the garage, not particularly well, in the lot, and then you go out to the lot. You want to remember where your car is. You know that it's in the lot. You have the general tendency, but you don't remember the specific space because you get interference with all the places that you parked on earlier days. Or the same thing if you're looking for your keys. You know, you put them usually in one place. That's what you remember. What you really want to remember is the last place. And these things are so easily solved in computers. It's sort of striking that evolution didn't figure out how to do this for us so that we could erase the old memories, just keep track of the current one. And then because we have this memory system that's not good at specifics, we have trouble with eyewitness testimony. We have trouble with scientific reasoning because we notice things that fit our theories and we don't notice things that don't fit our theories. The sort of consequences go on and on of this basic fact that instead of organizing our memory systematically the way that computers do, it's more like this giant shoebox. There's all this stuff in there, but it's hard to get at what you need, and that causes problems.
And this idea of this shoebox, or I guess a series of shoeboxes, or perhaps disconnected shoeboxes, and all the duct tape, these are some of the analogies that use versus something like Google, right? Where you can write in a word, hit the computer, and boom, there's the information.
Yeah, Google actually takes a few tips from human beings and how it works, but underlyingly it works like a computer. It has a master map of where everything's stored, which means that once Google gets the right cues, it can go back and it can retrieve, you know, a whole Shakespearean play, for example. So it's very well organized underlyingly, and then it takes some tips from humans about finding things that are the most needed, the most frequent, and so forth.
But is a difference also, comparing, you know, the computer to the brain, is that we have feelings and we have memories and we have experiences that if they don't cloud our judgment, certainly influence our thinking about the world.
That's right. We use just about anything as a reminder for what we're trying to remember. So we use our emotions. You know, you remember something when you were in a similar mood. Mm-hmm. We even use strange things like posture. So you're mentioning sitting up straight. If you're sitting up straight, when you hear this, you remember it better than if you try to remember it later while you're lying down. Because we just use anything that's a clue to the situation before in order to help us, because we can't just go straight there in the way that a computer could.
But that's a kludge because it's clumsy, but it is part of this problem-solving ability that
it's clumsy. It mostly gets the job done. It's not perfect. So, for example, eyewitness testimony is pretty poor. Like you may have read about the Sean Bell case that the officers were acquitted last week. And the officers may have been guilty. They may not have been guilty. But surely the reason they were acquitted is because there were like 30 eyewitnesses and they all had different stories. There's a thing on the Times website where they list each of the eyewitnesses and what they said. And it's just all inconsistent because our memory is not like a video recorder. Right. It's this clumsy and inelegant thing that combines sort of what you saw at the scene of the crime and what you thought about afterwards. It's just not very precise.
And also, I would think environment. I mean, you know, you put yourself in a certain environment and you can have certain images, or it feels like a certain kind of memory associated with that environment. Context, culture.
Exactly. Right? Context totally drives our memory. And I mean, again, that's sometimes for better and sometimes it's for worse.
Right. Well, why? And I often, if I smell something or I hear a piece of music, I'm back. You know, I'm 7 mm-hmm. years old, and I'm in a very specific room, and there are certain people in the room that I remember. Why is that such a powerful, that our senses are such a powerful conduit for memory?
I think smells can be distinct. So one of the big problems with our memory is that if there are a bunch of similar things, then we have trouble pulling them out. So if I want to know, what did I have for breakfast mm-hmm. yesterday? There's a bunch of memories of different breakfasts and earlier days and so forth. But if you get something that's really distinct, a particular smell that you haven't smelled in 20 years, well, then you have a lot less that's overlapping. So you have mm-hmm. a lot less risk of getting confused, basically.
And so part of the problem is just, in terms of memory retrieval, is just, you know, where in that shoebox is this
exactly.
little piece of
memory?
Exactly.
You get sort of 10 things that all could have been breakfast yesterday. I'm not sure was it breakfast the day mm-hmm. before, and you have trouble. So, a practical consequence, for example, as a pilot, they may not be able to remember, did I bring up the landing gear now or the day before? And so that's why pilots have to use checklists, because our memories aren't good at taking out what you really want to know, which is what just happened as opposed to what happened the last time you flew the plane.
And that memory gets contaminated. If we do something repetitively, then
exactly.
you sort of lose track of, did I do it today or was that yesterday that
exactly.
I was thinking?
One of the most frightening statistics in my book is that 6% of all skydiving fatalities are from people who simply forgot to pull the ripcord. And that's because of the same kind of interference. They pulled it, you know, on many occasions before, and it blurs together in their memory. They think they pulled it now, and they didn't.
So what you're saying is that, and perhaps part of our memory maybe worked in the savannas, you know, 5 or 10,000 years ago or more, and we haven't really sort of caught up with the evolutionary demands of today?
Well, I think it's a little bit worse than that. I think that our memory system, unless we actually intrude and try to change it through genetic engineering or something like that, is going to stay this way. So it's actually not just going back 5,000 years or 10,000 years, but it's going all the way back to the first multicellular life. Evolution found a way of building memory that's about doing things quickly,
mm-hmm.
and it just made that system better and better. And so it's committed to that system. That's evolutionary inertia. It's fully committed to that system. And for the things that we do as modern humans, it's just not a very good solution at all. But it's completely entrenched in our genomes. In order to build something different, you'd have to change hundreds or thousands of genes. You could sort of imagine, well, could there ever be a flying pig? And the correct answer is yes, there could be a flying mm-hmm. pig. Some pig could give birth to an offspring that flew, but it's very unlikely because you'd need hundreds of genes to change simultaneously. You'd need to change the bone density, the feathers, and all of this kind of stuff. More likely you'd get something that had, say, feathers, but the bone density would be too heavy and
it would never get off the ground.
And so we could change our memory a little bit in the direction of computers, but if you just change mm-hmm. it a little bit, it wouldn't really help. So that's what evolutionary inertia is about. Another way to think about it is like we're climbing a mountain range, and we're in a particular part of that mountain range. There are better solutions, but they're way off in the distance, and evolution is blind. It can't say, I should go back to the bottom and go mm-hmm. back up to the top. It has no foresight. And so we're stuck in this part of design space, this part of the mountain.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, and our guest is psychologist Gary Marcus. We're talking about his new book, and it's titled Kluge. I'll spell that for you, Kluge, subtitled The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind, and he is a psychologist, professor of psychology at NYU. Wrote an interesting story in the New York Times not so long ago, how much would you pay to have a small memory chip implanted in your brain if that chip would double the capacity of your short-term memory? 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the teachers and school support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, 185,000 men and women working for great public schools for every child. PSEA, Leadership for Public Education.
It's the final day of the spring membership drive here at WHYY 91 FM. If you haven't, for whatever reason, made a pledge of support, do it now and make it count toward this challenge from the Independence Foundation. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. You can pledge online at our secure server. Our mission here on Radio Times is to bring you as many in-depth discussions about as many important issues as we possibly can over the course of a year. We produce 500 live programs every year on Radio Times, and we try to keep you informed, all of us informed, about the important issues of the day. So make a pledge to ensure that this kind of programming continues here in the Delaware Valley. And again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. We are counting down. This all ends on Friday night tonight at 8 o'clock, so make that pledge. Thank you very, very much.
Support for WHYY comes from Freelancers Union, a nonprofit group providing advocacy, networking opportunities, as well as health, dental, and disability insurance to qualified members. Details at freelancersunion.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Today on the show, how the evolution of our brain explains why we are less than perfect. Gary Marcus is the author of a book called Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind, director of the NYU Center for Child Language, and also professor of psychology at New York University. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get a couple of callers in on the conversation. We've got Carl from North Philadelphia joining us. Hi, Carl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi there. I find what he's doing fascinating, but
good.
And I'm not a scientist, but
me
I
either.
Find his findings somewhat lacking objectivity, and that he finds that there's a fault with evolution. I mean, how can you determine that? Is it the fault with evolution, or is it come down to the choices that our society or societies have made how to use the memory or the body? I mean, you talk about the spine
right.
and back problems, but I mean, we choose to sit in a chair for so many days a week, so many hours a day, and, you know, altering our hip flexors and whatnot. So
that's a good question, Carl, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Gary,
I mean, one more point, if I make it.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at, you talk about the problems with memory and, you know, like pilots, but if you look at a lot of professionals and artisans, they have this uncanny ability to not have to remember to rely on memory and still get the job done.
That kind of recall, because it's so automatic, you mean?
And I don't know where that comes from, but I mean, so I have a little bit of a problem with his findings.
No, I appreciate the call. You raise a couple of good questions.
Yeah, there are two quick questions there. We'll see if my brain is kludgy enough to
figure
to
it out.
Keep them both there. The first one is, well, what we do with what we've got is of course, an important question. So,
because evolution takes you so far, right?
Evolution takes you so far. So, I mean, there are some things I think about the design, if you will, of the human mind and the human body and so forth that really are truly clumsy. And then there are things where we make it worse. So, the spine is an example where, from an engineering perspective, it's really not very well designed to support weight. It's like, if you have the spine of a quadruped, then you're distributing the load like on a bench, and that's a nice, sensible thing. But if you turn it up 90 degrees, then you basically have a flagpole. And flagpoles are good for holding flags. They're not good for holding big, heavy heads and big shoulders and so forth. So it really, from an engineering standpoint, isn't a very good thing. And
so
then
there's a sort of built-in design flaw.
There's a built-in design flaw that I think is, you know, you can objectively measure from the perspective of physics and engineering and so forth. And then, yeah, it is very silly that we spend so much time in chairs. Like
that only
aggravates the problem. Exactly. I mean, we're both wearing glasses. We've aggravated the visual systems that we have. We've pushed them harder than they were probably intended to go, looking at all this fine print and so forth. So, I mean, there are some places where you can say, look, there's an objective problem here, and then there are places where we make it worse, and sometimes we can try to find ways to make it better, which actually comes to the second part of your question, which is, why are experts so good? Well, it turns out that our saving grace is that if we practice things, we can get better at remembering them. So if you practice things many, many times, and you break them into chunks, it's easier. So you couldn't remember, say, 10 digits if I just rattled them off. But if you know that three of them are 212, and you know that that's the New York City area code, you break it into pieces, you can do better. And a lot of expertise is about breaking into pieces sort of complex stuff such that it all becomes familiar. The human mind is quite good at that. So that's sort of our best hope for dealing with the kludginess of memory.
But I'm also thinking about associations and remembering things. If you can build in some kind of quick association, one of those little tricks of remembering somebody's name is when you hear that name, is say something to yourself that will help you remind yourself who this person is or what
exactly
their name is.
And that's a workaround. That itself is a kludge. Like, if our memories were organized efficiently, we could remember anything on one trial in the way that a computer can. You type in a phone number, your cell phone remembers it. But what we have to do is to find associations in order to make them better, and we can do that when we remember to, but it's not automatic, and it's something that we sort of have to develop a talent for. It doesn't come naturally to us.
But isn't the ability to sort of synthesize information or to make those associations, I mean, part of that is what art is all about, which
Absolutely.
Is putting things together that have a sort of disparate, perhaps, you know, appearance or don't seem to fit together, that sort of creative energy is about solving some of those problems, but also making some of those associations. And if we were just a computer, could we do that?
Actually, the computer can do that too, and without, I mean, not necessarily as well, but there was a paper in the journal Science a few years ago where someone actually had a computer combine concepts, basically, and compete with Madison Avenue, like, interns. And the computer beat the interns pretty handily. There are actually two separate things going on. One is about combining concepts, and the other is about remembering stuff. And it turns out that we use things like free association to help us remember them, but Google can do something like free association, but also underlyingly have the structure of a machine and not have the unreliability. So they're actually separate questions. We put our association to excellent use in poetry and so forth, but we still sort of have, I think, have a raw deal when it comes to memory in objective terms. Like, you compare how much a computer can remember and how much people can remember, and there's no comparison.
Would you like to have a small memory chip implanted in your brain so you could remember better?
I would go for it, definitely.
You would go for that?
My whole professional life depends on being able to remember lots of stuff very well, and it's difficult.
But you say practice. I mean, this shouldn't be a revelation to anybody, but the practice does help.
Practice certainly helps, and what's called deliberate practice helps more. If you just, like, if you're playing chess every day against the same people that you can beat, that doesn't necessarily help. But if you play chess against people that are better than you and you study the mistakes that you make and so forth, then you can improve. The person who's done some of the most interesting research on this, Anders Ericsson, showed that an ordinary person could learn to memorize strings of 80 digits long by doing this chunking technique. So he took a guy who was a professional, or not a professional, but a serious runner,
right,
and he said, well, look at this. This 256, that's a good running time for a three-minute mile. And this 2417, this is good for a 2,500-meter dash or something like that. And by getting the guy to break things down into pieces, eventually he got to be where he could remember any string of 80 digits pretty well. On the other hand, it's still narrow, so he got very good at remembering the 80 digits, but he still couldn't remember his shopping list.
Oh, interesting. But are you saying that because of the age that we live in, that memory and this retrieval of information, that these are skills that we need to live in the information age, as we call it?
Yeah, I mean,
more than our ancestors did?
I think that we have more fine-grained demands on our memory. So we have to remember specific information, where our ancestors could usually get by with general, so remembering where there was more food in general. Whereas we have to remember specifically where our keys are, specifically where our car is. I mean, if you do something as dangerous as flying, you need to remember specifically whether you brought up the landing gear. And sometimes we have to give eyewitness testimony, and we have, you know, arguments about who said what on which particular time. So I think modern society does make a lot of demands on specific detail.
Let me get back to our callers. Carl, thanks for the call. We've got Elizabeth now from Philadelphia. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
My question is, if evolution is a series of steps that are enacted to help protect the living organism, in this case, the human, what are the possibilities or the chances of our inability to recall something that happened immediately, or our inability to store this memory and have a retrieval system like a computer, perhaps that's another mechanism to save us from something or to protect us from something?
So the idea that we might not be able to remember something actually might protect us from that memory, Elizabeth?
Correct.
I think it's a very optimistic view, and you're not the first person to ask me about that. I mean, on the whole, I think our memory is much better than nothing, and lots of the things that we remember are really important. But I think that people also get from Freud a notion that we have more control over our memories than we actually do. So Freud had this notion of memory repression.
Indeed.
There just doesn't
seem... There's
a hallmark of his theory, and just doesn't seem like there's a lot of empirical evidence for it. So when you think about it, you sort of take a step back. You realize, for example, that Holocaust survivors spend their whole lives trying to forget, and post-traumatic stress syndrome is another example of that, where people have a lot of trouble forgetting the things that they want to forget. So it's a nice idea that our memories would be sort of tuned to remember just the things that we want to remember and not the things that we don't want to remember. But the reality is that our memories just work by this kind of system of interference, and things where we have perfectly clear cues we can remember, and where there's a bunch of interfering things we have trouble. And sometimes that works out for us and sometimes it doesn't.
But you're also talking about this overlay of emotion, that if you've got trauma associated with a memory, that
makes it harder to forget.
Well, indeed, it makes it harder to forget, and it also can be a challenge for trying to sort of reconstruct what happened in the past.
That's right. Another consequence is what I call ruminative cycles, which is an example would be depression. So because your mood affects what you remember, when you're depressed, you remember things that are depressing. You put on some blues songs and listen to breakup songs and so forth, and then you get more depressed, and it cycles.
Right.
So If you had a system that could search its memory more objectively, you could say, well, these last couple of days have been really rough, but if you take the broader view, things are actually going pretty well. But our memory structures are such that we're always looking for something that's very related to the thing that's happening right now, and so we end up persisting in these cycles.
But isn't that what cognitive psychology is all about, which is to look at the conversation that people have with themselves and try to use that conversation to help them feel, if not just feel better, but also make improvements in their life, so to speak.
I think you're referring to cognitive therapy rather
than...
Yes. Yeah. Cognitive therapy, I think a lot of it is actually ways of coping with your sort of inner kludge. A lot of it is ways in which people have realized that human beings tend to fall into certain psychological traps. And part of the argument of the book is that we can understand why those psychological traps exist. So why, for example, do people get into these ruminative cycles? Right. What has to do with the structure of memory in the first place?
And let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Gary Marcus, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. We're talking about a memory and the human mind. He's a professor of psychology at NYU, New York University, director of the NYU Center for Child Language. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Stan from Downingtown to join us. Stan, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
And Doctor, I remember working in the NYU bookstore half a century ago.
Okay, go ahead, Stan.
But my question is, what about eidetic memory? People who have photographic memories, like Jerry Lucas, the ball player, who could look at a page of a phone book and recite everything on it in seconds.
I would like to see somebody like that up close.
You don't buy it?
I don't buy it. There are tricks that we can use, like the guy who remembers the 80-digit number, so we can break things down and get better and better. But the only report in the scientific literature, you can look this up on Slate, there's a little bit of an expose of it. The only report in the scientific literature was something like, I can't quite remember the details, but basically a husband was writing about a wife or something like that, and there hasn't been replication of it. So it's possible that it's true, but it's very hard to find good, scientific, reliable reports of photographic memory. There's a lot of anecdotes reporting it.
Hmm. But you're saying, you know, show me the evidence before...
I'm saying show me the evidence. I'd like to interview such a person.
Okay, but you're saying based on at least your theory of the mind, it doesn't make any... I mean, it just would overload the system?
It would be surprising. It's also possible that someone could, like, remember all the dots in an image or something like that, but not really interpret it. And so they could maybe delay it for a little while, but not necessarily comprehend all of the stuff that they're reading.
You have written about Eliot Spitzer. You wrote a piece on the Huffington Post, and this, of course, you know, the governor of New York who got tangled in a prostitution ring and also got tangled in some of the laws that he promoted when he was district attorney in New York. Does Kluge explain Eliot Spitzer to us?
Well, I mean, there are many different kluges in the human mind. There are many different spare parts that have been sort of cobbled together. That's what makes the brain a kluge. His behavior, I think, reflects one particular kind of schism, and this is where I think Freud is closer to the mark, which is between kind of a short-term system and a long-term system. And clearly, you know, the sexual desire that he was acting on is part of a shorter-term system. His long-term system presumably was interested in maintaining the governorship and trying to influence New York in positive ways and so forth. And those two systems are always in conflict. Evolution didn't really think, I mean, evolution doesn't think at all. Evolution didn't put them together very well. So among other things, the short-term system, I think, has the steering wheel just because it's the older system and not necessarily because it's a better system. So we have this very fancy system for making long-term plans that's maybe unique only to humans, but we're not always very good at actually letting it do its thing. The short-term goal system sees something and it seizes on it. What's especially interesting, I think, about his case is that he got the long-term system involved. It wasn't just that on the spur of the moment he saw this prostitute, but he did all of this kind of complicated, elaborate stuff to disguise the monetary transactions and so forth. So there, the short-term system, even though it's perhaps the less clever one and certainly less in the long-term interest, has hijacked the longer-term system, and that's pretty clumsy.
And you're saying this is how, I mean, he's not the only person to do this, and there are plenty
Hardly.
Of other examples not related to prostitution where this short-term, long-term impulses, needs, desires get tangled up.
I think it's the eternal human conflict.
Right.
Like,
I would agree.
We're the only species smart enough to make long-term plans, but so often we fail to actually carry through with them.
And you talk about the reflexive system, the deliberative system. That's another way of thinking of long and short term.
Yeah, the reflexive system, it it acts automatically. It sees a stimulus and it does something in relation to that stimulus.
The deliberative, and that's the old part.
That's the old part. That's the stuff that we share with all other animals. The deliberative stuff is basically unique to humans. There might be a little trace of it in monkeys and apes and so forth, but we clearly have the most elaborate goal system, and we can make long-term plans. We can say, I want to go back to school, or I want to lose weight, or whatever. And the challenge is always to translate that long-term system into the language that the short-term system actually understands.
And just to pick up on the weight example, I mean, as we know, most diets fail. People have the best of intentions, but then they pass, you know, a plate of brownies.
Exactly. So the intentions are in this sort of abstract language. I mean, they're actually in language. Mm-hmm. And the reflexive system doesn't understand that. So I think one of the best pieces of advice I give in the book, at the end there's a little section of advice, is to try to actively translate between the intentions and things that your reflexive system can understand. And what is that? Well, the reflexive system is all about, if I'm in a very particular circumstance, then I will do this particular action. That's what a reflex is. If I see this particular kind of stimulus, I'm going to do that kind of thing. So I, for example, have a problem that when I'm out socializing and I'm at a nice restaurant, people order dessert, I can't help myself. Like, otherwise, I wouldn't eat that cheesecake, but I'm talking and I'm not really distracted. So what I've been trying to do is to train myself for that particular circumstance. If I'm in a restaurant with a bunch of fascinating people, the dessert menu comes, I'm going to put my, I'm going to sit on my hands.
Literally sit on your hands.
Literally going to sit on my hands, or I'm going to go to the washroom, I'm going to turn away. So I practice these kinds of things so that I don't, when I'm not paying as much attention, you know, go with the ordinary reflex and eat the cheesecake.
Let me squeeze a caller on before we go to our second break. Gary, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. I have a question about evolution in general. You mentioned that evolution attempts to make small changes from organism to organism. Basically, it's a conservative movement.
Yeah, and Gary, we're almost up on...
The question is then, how do you explain existence of missing links and so-called evolutionary jumps?
Okay.
For example, there's nothing in between. We can't seem to find anything in between the ape and human.
Fair enough. Gary, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
There's two things. I think that that's mostly a matter of we just don't have a complete fossil record. So I think that there are small jumps. The other thing is that apes and humans in some ways aren't that big a jump anyway. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what we should be looking for. We're not actually derived from chimpanzees, but a common ancestor that no longer exists, and we don't have a lot of fossil evidence about exactly what that common ancestor is. But if you look at our genomes, we're only like 1.5% different from chimpanzees. So we are the small change from a chimpanzee. It's just a particularly fortuitous change that allows us to do a lot of complicated thinking.
And I'm not even saying your argument with evolution, but perhaps how people talk about evolution is just that this notion of the perfection of the human mind or species.
People's naive notion is that evolution is sort of always looking out for our best interests and is going to make us optimal or perfect. And really, evolution is satisfied with kind of good enough for government work. If it gets the job done, your genes propagate, and that's enough. That's all evolution needs. And sometimes, you know, that doesn't lead to a perfect solution.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our guest and to our callers, 1-888-477-9499. Gary, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Gary Marcus is our guest today on the show. His book is called Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. And after this short break, we'll be talking about beliefs and belief systems. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Opera Delaware supports WHYY and presents the regional premiere of Mark Adamo's opera Little Women, based on the novel by Louisa May Alcott. Featuring Catherine Szczesny, Grant Youngblood, and Margaret Thompson, Little Women will be performed at the Grand Opera House in Wilmington on May 4th, 9th, and 10th. Tickets and information at Opera Delaware's website, operade.org, or at the Grand Box Office, 1-800-37-GRAND.
It's the final day of the spring membership drive here at WHYY 91 FM. If you haven't, for whatever reason, made a pledge of support, do it now and make it count toward this challenge from the Independence Foundation. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or WHYY.org. You can pledge online at our secure server. Our mission here on Radio Times is to bring you as many in-depth discussions about as many important issues as we possibly can over the course of a year. We produce 500 live programs every year on Radio Times, and we try to keep you informed, all of us informed, about the important issues of the day. So make a pledge to ensure that this kind of programming continues here in the Delaware Valley. And again, that phone number is 1-888-345-9499. We are counting down. This all ends on Friday night, tonight at 8 o'clock. So make that pledge. Thank you very, very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Talking, there's a Kluge, if there ever were one. Gary Marcus is our guest, and he's written a book called Kluge, and I will give you, again, his definition of what he means by the word Kluge: a clumsy or inelegant yet surprisingly effective solution to a problem. We are talking about memory, the human mind. We might even save a little bit of room for language, because I know that's something else that you have done a lot of work on. Gary, let's talk a little bit about belief systems. You have a whole chapter in this, and this is an interesting part of this whole discussion about, I guess, memory and the human mind.
Well, I mean, belief stems from memory. I mean, everything that we believe is stored in our memory. And so one of the things I mean about memory being the mother of all kludges is that other things like belief depend on it. And because memory has its problems, belief inherits them. So one example of that is confirmation bias. So You have some kind of theory. You have a particular favorite presidential candidate. And then you think about the evidence. Is that person the best presidential candidate? And what happens is your memory finds things that match. So you remember things that support your theory, but you're not necessarily looking for the things that don't support your theory. And so people become polarized over time because everybody notices the evidence for their own theory, and they never give equal time to the evidence for the other theory.
Because what is familiar is comfortable, or it just it's partly computes, because it resonates?
It's mostly because we search our memories. You can think of like a query on Google. You're looking for things that match particular criteria. But what's relevant for scientific reasoning is things that don't match that criteria. You want to have both the things that support your theory and the things that don't. But our memory, because it's relying on these cues, is all about matching. That's sort of all it can do. You say Obama and you think about things for Obama. That doesn't lead you automatically to think about the corresponding things about Clinton.
But in order to then address this, as you describe this sort of clues or problem of the mind, then you have to actively, in a sense, sort of short-circuit your belief system in order to get opposing information.
That's right. So part of graduate school training, for example, is really getting people to think about alternative hypotheses. And you can make that a reflex, too. Mm-hmm. And when you do, then you're going to be a better reasoner. But when people start off, you don't naturally think about alternative hypotheses. Human beings have been described as using, quote, make sense reasoning. And what that means is you see an argument, it makes sense to you, and you stop instead of saying, well, is there another argument here? Because there could be sort of four arguments that make sense, but people have another term for it is premature closure. They get to the first one, they're happy, and they say, I've got a reason why, you know, my favorite candidate should win, and they stop there. And it's not really built into the structure of the mind that we should give equal time to hypotheses on both sides. And then it's also tied in with our pleasure system. So we get a little kick when we think that we're right.
Of course.
And so, like, if a student gets an A on an exam, they're like, oh, great. If they get a C on the exam, they're like, oh, the questions must not have been fair. And so people will analyze something more if it makes them unhappy than if it makes them happy.
And just to underscore what you said, and you write this in the book, that when you hear something for the first time, the impulse is to believe it.
That's right.
And then after that, if you take the next steps, then you begin possibly to question.
It's sort of like shoot first, ask questions later. I think this comes from our perceptual system. So when you see something, you can trust that it's there. If you see a tree, there's probably a tree there. But if you hear something, especially in this era of spin doctors and so forth, it's not necessarily true. But studies show that when you hear something, you tend to automatically accept it. And only if you have more time do you decide, maybe this is right, maybe it's wrong. Advertising counts on that. You know, political advertising can count on that too.
So what about, so this idea of seeing is believing? I mean, we say that. That's, I mean, in a very cliched way, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, and hearing is believing.
And hearing is believing.
And it shouldn't necessarily be. And reading is believing, and it shouldn't necessarily be. That's another way in which we're kludgy, is that we're a little bit too quick to accept information from the outside. It's sort of a luxury when we can consider something. We don't automatically do that.
But we have to teach ourselves in a way.
We have to teach ourselves to do it.
And I do want to talk about some of the advice that you have here, and also you do talk about education a bit as well. Mm-hmm. But let's get some callers in on the conversation. Gary Marcus is our guest. We're talking about the haphazard construction of the human mind. That's the subtitle of his new book, and it's called Kluge. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Jody to join us. Hi, Jody. Go ahead, your radio times.
I would like to hear a little bit about how maybe attention impacts recall, mm-hmm. or maybe lack of attention, specifically as I've gotten older, what I realize is my plate is more full, and figuratively speaking, and my ability to recall, I believe, might be related to how much I've got
sure.
to store.
Well, mm-hmm. and Jody, thanks for the call. I've often heard, Gary, people say, you know, well, my hard drive is full. I just have too much information. That's why I can't remember anything.
There's probably some truth in that. So, I mean, as I was saying before, one of the biggest problems with our memory is if too many things match the criteria that we're trying to search for, basically. You get overlap, and you can't quite pick out one thing from the next. So this is the problem with where is your car in the parking lot. It's overlapping with too many previous memories. Excuse me. It's also the case that attention is a very big part of memory. So if you don't pay attention to something in the first place, you don't remember it. And if you're not focused, then you might not filter out the memories that you need. And finally, and this is not a happy fact, but it's true that our memories decline over time. So the brain is like any other part of the body, that it's fragile and it decays over time. And so
and just wears out, or that whatever retrieval system we have is just not as elastic.
It's not as elastic. The neurons don't fire as efficiently and so forth. I mean, these declines are gradual, but it is a fact of life, just like declining vision is. So I will soon be wearing bifocals. There's nothing I can do about that.
Well, join the club, if I might say so myself. But you also say in this book that, you know, thinking has to be taught. And I think maybe that was just a revelation to me, but I think people think, well, you know, humans think. That's what we're, in a sense, built to do. But you're saying, no, we are reflexive thinkers, but perhaps not the kind of deep thinkers we think we are.
That's right. I think it's astonishing that schools teach children, there's a clue, teach children about how digestion works, how the circulatory system works, but there's no real education about how thinking works. And we do just naturally think, but we don't necessarily naturally think in objective ways. We don't necessarily have good memories. And there are lots of tricks you can use to improve your memory, to think more objectively, and so forth. And there's actually some nice scientific evidence now that if you teach young children, like 8 and 10-year-olds, about philosophy and get them to reflect on how they think, then they do better. Their verbal scores go up. Their self-confidence goes up. So I think it would be a really great thing to give children a little bit more training, sort of a user's guide to the human mind. You know, this is what you can expect that you're going to do efficiently, and this is where you might expect that you're going to have problems.
So I certainly remember having to memorize, you know, lists of you know, bones, and I mean, I'm thinking of all the things we have to memorize in school. You're saying
we have to memorize entirely too much. I mean, especially in the age of Wikipedia, like it's important to memorize multiplication facts because you can't be fiscally numerate unless you have a times table in your head. But it's not necessarily important to memorize a list of bones or state capitals. You can learn, you can look those things up on the web. I think it would be better to give children more training in how they think and how they have trouble. So another like common everyday example is if you ask two people who share an apartment, how much of the dishes do you do? One person's going to say 60%. The other person's going to say 70%. The numbers are never going to add up to 100%. Everybody's going to think they did more than their share of the work, and that's inevitably going to lead to conflict. Now, the reason that we do that is because our memory is better at remembering the things that we do than the things that other people do, and worse than that, we're just not very good at compensating and doing what a pollster would do and say, well, how representative is this data? Is this biased sample? And so forth. And so people get themselves into easily avoidable conflicts. If they would realize that there are biases in how their memories are serving up the data, then they could avoid the conflicts. They could say, okay, yeah, I think I'm doing 60%, but probably I'm overlooking these other things, and maybe it's fairer than I realize. So a lot of conflict, personal conflict, military conflict, and so forth, I think could be avoided if people recognize the biases in their own reasoning and so forth.
And that's Gary Marcus, our guest today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Listen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
And And we are here, myself, Susan Greenbaum, and myself, Susan Palenko. And we're enjoying, I'm really, really enjoying this conversation, Susan. I have to say, the way the human mind works and the ways in which it doesn't work, or the ways in which we think it works, is that this guy, Gary Marcus, is really talking about that chasm between what we think and what actually happens. And it's fascinating.
We need something else to happen. We need everybody who's listening to give us a call, join up, become members of WHYY at 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. It's the May membership drive. It is May, isn't it?
It is May 2nd today, the second day of May, and this will be the last time for people to show their support for Radio Times at this point in time and during this break. So we would like to hear from you. 1-888-345-9499. If you are a regular Radio Times listener, you need to step forward and make that pledge of support. Membership begins at $50, but if you can afford to go a little higher at the $75 level, you can get the WHYY Eco Fabulous Canvas Grocery Tote. And if you have a large family and you would like four of those, that is for a pledge of $200 that you can get. And any pledge you put on a credit card over $50, if you ask for it, you can also get Newsweek magazine. So,
sounds good. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Susan, we always say, like, we need our listeners to call in and make a pledge. The fact is, we do need your support.
Yes.
But what's so interesting about all this is that it's your choice. You can choose to not become a member of WHYY and rely on your neighbor who supported WHYY, or you can choose to become part of this incredible experiment of public broadcasting that was started so many years ago that thrives and exists solely, mostly because of people just like you who hear public broadcasting, listen to WHYY day in and day out. It would be a wonderful world if everybody who listens became members. It's just not the way it is, unfortunately. But it is your choice, and you can choose to support public broadcasting in your neighborhood at the $50 level, the $75 level, the $100 level, whatever level fits your pocketbook and your budget. We don't tell you what we charge you. We don't tell you what this is worth to you. You determine the value of programming like Radio Times with Marty Moscoen in your life. But what we're asking is that you reflect upon what this means to you.
And how much you get out of it.
And then put your own price tag on it. Become a member. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. And we should mention, the Independence Foundation has challenged 350 listeners of Radio Times to become members during our quick pledge breaks. And if we do hear from 350 members who become members during our pledge breaks, then the Independence Foundation will give us $10,000. Now, we're very close, and we have about five more minutes to get there, and we're working on a tally right now. We'll let you know in a few minutes if we've made it. My hunch is we will, because folks like you understand the importance of membership in WHYY and of making your dollars go even further. So that number is 1-888-345-9499.
Now, Susan, I was talking to Mike and Scott the other day, who happens to be from Germany, and she mentioned that in her home country, everyone contributes to public broadcasting on an annual basis.
Do they have to?
It's everybody. It's like when you go get your license, or
really?
I'm not quite sure how it works, but she says it's not voluntary. It's just automatically supported by everyone in the country.
Huh.
Now, we don't have that system here.
Nope. We have an honor system.
We have an honor system. I'm not arguing that we should change the system.
Good.
Although, I think, you know, like when you go get a license.
That'll stir up some controversy.
Well, when you go get a license at the DMV, they ask you if you want to be an organ donor. Why not ask, do you want to support public radio?
Hey.
That might be a problem, but just think about it. You don't have to, it's not built into your day.
Right. It's not mandatory. But it's a choice.
If listening is built into your day, then membership should be part of the fabric of what you do. It should be part of the fabric of your life. And I'm asking you, Radio Times listeners, to show your support for the talented Marty Moscowane and her staff, Susan Greenbaum, Alan Tu, and Devorah Lissick. 1-888-345-9499. I am an avid listener of Radio Times, and I have to tell you, Marty Moscowane is one of the first voices I heard besides Dan Gottlieb's when I moved here.
Really?
9 years ago.
Very nice.
And I thought to myself, who is this Marty Moscowane? I thought it
who
was
is this wizard?
I thought it was Moscowane.
She's
all
a
one
wonderful,
word.
Wonderful person. 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. Please do show your support. Give us a call. 1-888-345-9499. We've had a fascinating week here at Radio Times. And in about 15 minutes, the staff of Radio Times is all going to sit. We're going to sit down and we're going to go through it and
dissect it, breathe a heavy sigh, take it apart,
and figure out what worked and what didn't work, and use that information to plan our week next week.
And that's a good point that you make, that you guys continuously try to improve what you do.
Hey, we're strivers.
Right.
1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org is the place to pledge online. Give us a call, 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org. In a minute, we're going to get a tally on where we stand with this Independence Foundation challenge. But in the meantime, assure that it happens. 1-888-345-9499. WHYY.org.
And another thing to think about is that Radio Times, what I love about it is that you guys can switch gears too, that you can do a very serious topic and then you can shift and do a less serious topic.
On Friday afternoon, I feel like, I said this yesterday, I feel like talking about flowers or shoes.
Right, and that's fine because there's plenty of people who are interested in that and who would be happy to listen.
We talk about gardening, and once Marty Moscowane talked about shoes on the show.
Right, so the idea is that the breadth of topics.
Once we even talked about how women go about buying bathing suits.
Oh, yeah.
That was and we got a lot of calls.
I'm sure
1-888-345-9499-WHYY.org. You know, buying bathing suits.
That's a perplexing problem.
Totally. It's worth an hour conversation as far as I'm concerned. 1-888-345-9499-WHYY.org. Don't forget, if you become a member at the $75 level, we won't send you a bathing suit. But what we will send you, if you ask for it, is a WHYY eco-friendly grocery bag. It's Think Globally, Listen Locally. Do I have that reversed?
No, that's right.
Good.
Think Globally, Listen Locally, WHYY 91 FM.
That's for your pledge of $75, 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. And don't forget, even if you become a member at the most basic level, $50 a year, that's a whole year, and you put your pledge on a credit card, we'll send you a year subscription to Newsweek magazine.
Right.
$50 a year.
That's a great deal. Right. And just think about it. And also
think what you spend on your coffee.
Yeah. And think about the fact.
My husband does that to me all the time. If I do something every week, he tallies it up and says to me, you know how much you spend a year on this?
Oh.
But whatever.
I don't know if I would want to hear that. Right. But if you think about